This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good morning, everyone. There may still be a few people coming in, but for the sake of brevity, we'll start and let them wander in at their own pace. Firstly, thank you all for coming. For those of you who haven't met me before, I'm Frances. I'm looking after the Friends. Many of you I've met before. This is our last landmark talk for the year, and I wanted to thank all of you who have been regulars and those that have come spasmodically as time allows. We've really appreciated your support and I hope you've enjoyed the program. Just to reassure you, we're locking in the program for next year. We've got some people lined up already for February, which I'll let you know. It's actually the ladies from the Handmade Markets, which should be interesting. So I'll be sending out an email next week about that. Before I introduce our speaker, just a little bit of admin. For those of you that come, you know that we'll be recording the session. So if you've got any questions, please wait for the mic so we can capture your questions. And if you could turn your mobile phones off. A little bit of a sales pitch. The shopping night is coming up on Friday the 5th. So that's one of our most popular events and it'll be starting at 5:30. There's an e-card that's already gone out. So if you haven't booked in already, either give myself or Wendy a call or go on to Eventbrite and book yourself in. It should be a lovely night. 5th of December, yep. We're expecting a big crowd too, so. So on to today's event. Unfortunately, our scheduled speaker, Maureen Kane, broke her knee, so at the last minute had to pull out. I have advised most of you, but if you didn't know, I apologise. And so the lovely and distinguished Michelle Hetherington, one of our senior curators, has stepped in at the last minute with grace and dignity, so thank you, Michelle. Michelle is one of the senior curators here at the National Museum in the Australian Society and History Program. She's researched and developed a number of major exhibitions for both the National Library and the National Museum, including Paradise Possessed, the Rex Nan Kivel Collection, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, The World Upside Down Australia, 1788 to 1830, which was a winner of the Centre of Australian Cultural Studies Award in 2000, Cook and Amai, The Cult of the South Seas, and Exploration and Endeavour, The Royal Society of London and the South Seas. She was lead curator on Glorious Days Australia 1913, which I hope many of you came to in 2013, and the National Museum's contribution to, which was the Canberra contribution to the Canberra Centenary Year, sorry. She was also commissioning editor of the book of the same name. Michelle's numerous publications reflect her interest in European voyages of discovery, the 18th century, and the cult of celebrity, and the work of Australian and British artists. She is a co-editor of Discovering Cook's Collections and is a contributor to Celebrity, the Idiom of a Modern Era, 2013, which all sounds very interesting. So please thank Michelle for stepping in at the last minute and welcome her to Landmark Women this morning.
Thank you very much, Frances, and thank you all for coming. Welcome and good morning. So, I'm Michelle Hetherington, and I've been thinking about what I could say to you that has sort of a landmark women's... Is that better? Can you hear me now? If at any point you can't hear me, just wave a hand at me, OK? I was wondering, what was the best way to approach the honour of being invited to speak as a landmark woman? And I decided that perhaps I could dilate on the importance of following those things that are most of interest to you rather than the things that appear to be the normal path to achieve your heart's desires. Okay, so here we go. I was born in Perth in 1959 and I had a fairly sort of unusual route to get to the University of Western Australia. My parents took me out of school at the age of 16, despite the fact that I desperately wanted to go to uni, and put me in the public service as a curatorial assistant, the lowest of the low. And it was dreadful, as I'm sure they knew it would be, and it encouraged me to go back to school and get my living equivalent. And I then tried nursing briefly and discovered that I did not like being told what to do by other people very much. So I decided I would come to uni. And I had a marvellous time. UWA back in those days was like a giant garden on the edges of the river, very comfortable, very quiet, very beautiful. And I'm not sure I worked quite as hard as I should have, but I got through. And I met my husband there, and he did his PhD there too. As a result of discovering a great passion for art, I actually took a break from being at university just before I'd finished my degree. And this is something that quite surprised me. As a small child, I'd loved painting and drawing and had never really thought that it was something that you could devote yourself to. But I ended up spending 3 very happy years full-time at the Clermont School of Art, 2 years prior to that part-time, and then I taught for a year whilst waiting for the birth of my second child. Now, when that child was nearly 3, my husband got a posting at this organisation, the National Library of Australia, and we, of course, went across and joined him. We'd been in Canberra for about 9 months when I got my first job there, and it was a wonderful little 6-month contract. I was very sad when it came to an end, but it was really, really worthwhile having a job, partly because when I came to Canberra, everybody would say, "Oh, and what do you do?" And if I said, "I'm looking after my young child," they would just sort of glaze over and turn to the next person in the hope that they might have something interesting to say. So I worked as the executive officer of the TDK Audio Book Award, which was lots of fun and an enormous education for me. I had to learn to use a computer, which was okay because nobody else really knew how to use one either. Now, my time at the library, 13 and a half years in all, was again one of those experiences where if you follow what you're interested in, interesting things will happen to you. So I'd arrived with a degree in English literature and history and a diploma in fine arts, majoring in sculpture, neither of which appeared to have much to do with learning to use a computer. But I persevered, and I had a lovely time in the education section. I was also, before that, the executive officer of the Friends of the National Library for 3.5 years, and in fact, I'm sure I met some of you there during that time. Very hard job, and we should all be deeply grateful to people like Francis who are prepared to undertake it. Whilst there, I thought, I need to do something that links the two tasks, the two bits of qualification that I have achieved so far. So I undertook a diploma in art, postgraduate diploma in art history and curatorship at the ANU. And this is the very beautiful view just outside the AD Hope building where I did most of my studying. This was an inspired choice because it turned out that I had great lecturers and tutors, and the fact that I could write clearly, knew something about history, knew some grammar, and also understood fine arts, set me up perfectly for being able to research the history of art and write about it with a degree of coherence. The curating part of the degree or diploma was very theoretical, and I think the idea was to prepare us all for a job as a curator, and given that there were lots of us wanting such a position, I'm not sure how many of us were going to actually achieve that desire. But whilst it did not prepare me really to curate, it gave me the piece of paper that allowed people in authority to decide that I would be capable of doing such a thing. And that happened for me at the National Library in 1998. Now, I had been for some time in the library, when I was in the education section, putting together those lovely displays in those big glass cases that they used to have off the entrance. My very favourite was the Christmas cards that were sent to Prime Minister Menzies and Patty Menzies by the royal family. It was wonderful. The only problem was that people kept on banging their heads on the glass plate windows as they were trying to read the inscriptions. But so I'd done those sorts of things. And one of my final bits of work for my postgrad diploma, I was required to curate an exhibition on paper. And I decided that I would curate an exhibition about this man, Sir Rex de Schorenbach Nankivell. This is a picture of him in 1959 at Australia House in London, handing over a sizeable chunk of his amazing collection to the High Commissioner. And you can see a painting by... I'm going to have trouble with this now. I should have checked it all again. The artist of the third voyage to the Pacific under Cook. I'll remember it in just a minute, don't worry. And he's also showing you the albums in which he has pasted photographs of all the paintings. He was trying to organise what was an unruly and somewhat distributed collection into a way that he could manage it and that other people could know what he had. His passion was 18th century voyages of discovery, a passion that I soon grew to share with him. But the idea for the exhibition was that it was going to be called Portraits of a Collector, because he also had a huge interest in portraits. The only book that he really published was called Portraits of the Famous and Infamous. And he did say in a letter, "I never did much like missionaries. I'm never sure that those who are famous might not be infamous." So anyway, I put forward my proposal, and my boss at the library at that time said, "Well, you can actually have a little bit of time to work on this proposal if you agree to do it for the library as a real exhibition, not just a potential exhibition." That was great. I did all the work and suddenly was told, "Oh, we've decided that as it is Rex's centenary coming up, we need an exhibition, but we don't want that little one that you've thought up. We want a big one." So at the age of 39, having never curated a major exhibition in my life and having no idea what it really involved, I said, "Yes, of course." And saying yes has got me into lots of trouble throughout my life, but it's also brought me many, many wonderful opportunities. And so I spent the next 6 months working away, putting together an exhibition that became known as Paradise Possessed. It was magnificent from my point of view. I discovered the joy of just working from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. I had lovely people to work with and the most amazing collection to get to know. I knew that I was pushing it a little hard the time I dreamt that Rex Nankivell spoke to me and said, "You've forgotten the second voyage." I woke up in the morning and thought, "Oh my God, I've forgotten Cook's second voyage." So I think when somebody who's been long dead speaks to you in your dreams, you know that you're on a certain wavelength. Anyway, this is the portrait of Rex that he commissioned for himself. So whilst his passion was 17th, 18th and 19th century art and artefacts, he earned his living as a purveyor of fine art, modern art. And so he had a modern artist portray him in this way. And this one I did put in the exhibition. This was the cover for the book. And this was another thing that I discovered once I became a curator, as I could call myself, having done this particular exhibition. Exhibitions are ephemeral. They will be gone. In fact, when I was racing to put together this PowerPoint display, I discovered that a lot of the material that was once on the web about the exhibitions I've created, it's all gone. And so you need to have a book so that people can remember it and so that you can express your thoughts about what it was that you were thinking at the time. I wrote the introductory essay, and we were able to put together a selection of essays by really interesting people. And fortunately, my husband was at that time the publisher of the National Library of Australia. I don't think it's nepotism as such, but it was certainly very helpful. And it sold well and set in train a habit for the library of producing beautiful exhibition catalogues. So that exhibition was only meant to be up for 3 months, but they kept it up for 6 because there was such interest. And, of course, that's very gratifying. But as I'd been working on the Nankivell collection, I kept on discovering these amazing things about the early history of Australia, things that might be considered the eyewitness view to history. And so I put forward a proposal to do my next exhibition, which I wanted to call The World Upside Down, and to look at how the Europeans on their first arrival in Australia and up to the death of George IV, had seen the country. It was a fantastic exhibition to do. Oh, sorry. I've got ahead of myself. I have to quickly go back. This painting was one that I put into Paradise Possessed. It's by George Carter. It's the death of Captain Cook. Its date is about 1780-81. News of Cook's death, which had happened in 1779, reached England late in 1780, and a number of artists, including Weber, it was John Weber, was the author of that painting, I couldn't remember, including John Weber, who had actually been with Cook at the time of his death. Now, this painting had been purchased by Rex during the Second World War, and he was a great raconteur and embroiderer of his own life, which I think is an admirable thing to do. It's quite creative, as long as you don't go too far. He, of course, had the wrong birth date included on his funeral headstone, and that was because he wished to hide from the world that he was illegitimate, which at that time was a dreadful blot on your future. And so no one can really blame him for that. But having changed the date, he also reinvented many of the circumstances of his life, making it much more exciting and interesting. And then he actually lived a much more interesting and exciting life, having created for himself this backstory that made him acceptable to the upper-class English clients whom he sourced art for. Anyway, this painting was being sold. It was during the Blitz in London, and the auction house had already been bombed out of their normal building, and so they were holding the auction in a new premises that had, unfortunately, a glass ceiling over the atrium where the auction was being held. The sirens began to sound. Everybody started to race out of the room for the safety of the shelters, and the auctioneer turned to Rex and said, "Shall we repair to the shelter, sir?" And Rex said, "No, no, please continue." And he refused to go until they'd finished dealing with this painting, this lot. He got it for a song, not surprisingly. And so I felt that this was an essential painting to have in the exhibition because of the way it was acquired and the way it was so absolutely in keeping with his approach to life, but also because it was a painting of one of his great heroes. Cook came from very undistinguished origins. One would not normally have expected a man without money or family connections, such as he had, to do well in the 18th century, and yet he had managed, through dint of hard work and skill, to become a captain in the Royal Navy and to have the amazing career he subsequently had. I think Rex identified with him and saw him as a bit of a hero. This was really my first interaction with Captain Cook, and we've sort of been working together ever since, as you'll see. So this was The World Upside Down, the exhibition that then followed on from Paradise Possessed, and it was a delight to do. I really, really enjoyed it. This one is still up on the web, as you can see. I'm not sure how many of you are fascinated by the art of early Australian history, white Australian history, but it is really extraordinary. So that one went very well, and we won a prize for it. I did a number of other exhibitions at this time, including Cook and Oh My, The Cult of the South Seas. Cook had come back, and this time I actually had lots of time to learn all about him and found it absolutely fascinating. This was an exhibition that I curated in conjunction with the ANU, and so I got to meet lovely people like Ian McCalman and others from the Centre for Historical Research at that time. It also introduced me to Omai, who was the first Polynesian man, or first Polynesian, to reach London, where he became an extraordinary celebrity, and Nankervell had again collected widely on Omai's life. The National Library has one of the best collections relating to Omai in the world. Now, this exhibition was at about the time that I moved from being a curator into the pictures branch, about which we won't say much. But I did learn a lot in pictures, I must say. And then, in 2005, I came to the National Library, National Museum. Now, whilst I was in the pictures branch, I had a little bit of time to recover from all the hard work of being a curator. And this was a painting that I had displayed in the Cook and Omai exhibition. And I was asked by somebody, "Oh, so you've worked out the provenance of that painting, have you? We've always wondered who's actually in it." And in my naivety, I had read the label on it and thought, "Oh, great, Captain Cook, Joseph Banks, Lord Sandwich, excellent, I'll just pop it up on the wall." Turned out that none of that had been clearly established with proper research. It was hearsay, as it were. It had also been thought to have been painted by Zoffany at one point. So it was somewhat problematic work. And I spent about a year doing very detailed research into the painting's background. I was able to do it all from Canberra using the National Library's collections and resources. And when the paper was finally published in 2003 in the British Art Journal, I had learnt a vast amount about researching paintings, and I had discovered, in fact, that the man standing in the middle is Captain Cook, the man sitting on the bank is Banks, Joseph Banks, the man standing behind him is Daniel Solander, the fellow leaning with such an air of nonchalance on the sculpture is Lord Sandwich, First Lord of the Admiralty, and the fellow in the shadows is John Hawkesworth, who was the editor of the first publication of Cook's Voyage. It took a lot of work to do all of that, and there are some people who still don't agree with me. I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, this is the earliest portrait of Captain Cook yet discovered. But what I discovered when I was discovering Cook was that you can learn to interpret a painting in such an interesting way. I won't go into it at length here because otherwise we'll run out of time. But the centre of the painting, whilst it appears to be Cook, is in fact Lord Sandwich. You'll notice that they're all looking at Sandwich, apart from Dr. Hawkesworth, and while Cook doesn't actually appear to meet Lord Sandwich's gaze, he is actually making a bow to him. He's taken off his hat. It is a piece of hat honour, such as a man of lower status owed to a man of higher status, a son to his father, a subject to his monarch, and he's doing it in the approved form. You know, the way he's holding it is the approved form. It's a very genteel and courteous act, and he is saying, "I am paying my respects to the First Lord of the Admiralty." Not surprisingly, it was the First Lord of the Admiralty who commissioned this work. Interestingly enough, Cook would be inappropriate if he were to actually be meeting Sandwich's gaze. It is not his place to do so. So I ended up writing a paper called Knowing One's Place as a result of this, because I became absolutely fascinated with the whole idea of the hierarchical structure of British society at this time and how we make so many mistakes in trying to understand the history of the period if we assume that our cultural mores are theirs. Okay. Now, as a result of all the work I'd been doing on Cook, I got an opportunity to come and work here at the National Museum. It started out as an 18-month contract, and then when I was offered another 18 months, I asked the library if they would let me stay, and they said, "No, come back or resign," which was a bit sad because it was right on the evening of the opening of my next big exhibition here, and so the museum very kindly transferred me across, which I thought was fantastic, and I've been here ever since, having a great time. But they encouraged me to move here in the first place because they needed somebody to work on Captain Cook. I don't know if any of you remember the 2003 Carroll report into the National Museum. There were elements of it that suggested that Captain Cook should have a higher profile here, and also that there should be more about sport. And in response to the report, the museum said, certainly, we will do a new module on Cook and a new module on sport. And I was brought in to work on Cook. So just outside this theatre, we had the opportunity to do a module called Encounters, which is not the same as the big exhibition that's opening here next year. What it was an exhibition that looked at the points where cultures have encountered Australia, the continent. And so, of course, it began with the Indigenous people and their extraordinary knowledge of the continent over so many thousands of years. And then we looked at the early voyages by the Dutch and the French and the English. Then we looked at Captain Cook, of course. And then we looked at the early encounters between white Europeans and the Indigenous people at Botany Bay and then Port Jackson. So it was lots of fun. And what I'm showing you at the moment is the artist's layout for the design for one section of the module. When we start curating, you have an idea. You have a rough idea of the parameter, what you're trying to achieve. In this case, the moments of encounter in the history of Australia. And then you look for the objects. What have we got? What can we use? If the objects aren't in this institution, are they somewhere else? Can we borrow them? You have to write a lot of loan letters as a curator. What images can I use? Can I borrow paintings, or do I have to use graphic images? Then you have to actually create a narrative. I'm a great one for following a narrative, because I think that that's a great way to allow people to enter in to an exhibition. It's just telling a story in a particular way. It doesn't always have to be a linear narrative, but that often helps. And depending on how much space and time you've got to devote to the analysis of your thesis, a linear narrative will often do much of the work for you, because your audience is always intelligent and always able to piece the bits together if you give them enough information to go on. So this was the one about the establishment of the First Fleet and the colony in Sydney. And when we've put all of those elements together, we have a designer who says, okay, this is how I think we should lay it out. And so there's quite a lot of interaction. No, that needs to go here. Oh, I think that's nice. You know, it's always a good idea to find out what your designer has in mind, because their ideas may well be better than your own. This was the exhibition that I was working on when I moved permanently to the museum. This was an opportunity that Cook again brought me. There was an exhibition being shown in Hawaii of material that had been collected by Captain Cook and the men on board each of the three ships that he took. Well, actually, it was more than three. It was five ships that went to the Pacific on the three different voyages. And it had ended up at Göttingen in Hanover, which is where, of course, King George III was still sort of titular elector at the time of Cook's voyages. And a man called Johann Blumenbach, who was an early anthropologist, I think we would probably call him, was fascinated by the Pacific and wanted to acquire a collection of objects to explore the nature of humankind. That material was preserved extremely well by the Germans for over 200 years, and so in 2005-06, it travelled to Hawaii, taking items that had been collected in 1778 and 1779 back there for the very first time. And this is incredibly important because, of course, those Cook voyages transformed the Pacific. People who had previously not known metal, people who were living with stone tools, were suddenly exposed to completely different culture, completely different tools, new and unfortunate diseases and weapons that completely disrupted the existing hierarchy. So this exhibition, I got a chance to go to Hawaii to see it because we thought we might like to bring it to Canberra. And I'm not sure how many of you got to see it, but I think it looked even better here in Canberra than it had in Hawaii, because we were able to provide it with a preface for Australian audiences that allowed them to see how this material fitted into the European exploration of our own region. The feathered figure is the depiction of one of their rather terrifying gods, and when you're actually in the presence of this strange object made of wicker and feathers, it is incredibly powerful. It's such an extraordinary experience, one that you wouldn't really expect. It's also very scary. No, it is. You have to, anyway. So, my next big Cook exhibition was not so much about Cook, but we had to use Captain Cook as a sort of hook to get audiences to come. I was asked, we were all asked, who would like to curate an exhibition for the 350th anniversary of the foundation of the Royal Society of London? I went, me! And it was wonderful. I got to go and work in the reading room of the Royal Society for a week in London, and a selection of objects had already been identified that we were welcome to borrow if we wished. And so using those as the basis, I then worked out what else we might need and had a chance to go through their extraordinary collection of letters and documents. The Royal Society from 1660 really transformed the Western mind, I think. It taught people that this is how you save information, this is how you can retrieve information so that you don't have to constantly reinvent the same set of discoveries, which is what had been happening for quite some time. Now, Captain Cook did feature quite strongly in the exhibition, but it also allowed me to work much more strongly on Joseph Banks, who, is sometimes portrayed as this sort of wealthy playboy in the Pacific on Cook's first voyage. But the more I got to learn about the Cook voyages, the more I understood the incredible significance of Banks's role and the role he had in Cook's fame and in that of Omai, amongst many others. And he, of course, became the longest-serving president of the Royal Society from 1778 until his death in 1820. So that was another one of the exhibitions here that was so much fun to put together. And so we get to Banks. Now, one of the great things about being a curator, apart from the fact that you get to travel a lot and do a lot of reading, I occasionally have people go past my office and say, "Are you doing any work?" Because I'm sitting there reading a book. But that is my work, and it's very enjoyable. And so one of the things we have to do, of course, is huge amounts of research. And we have a research centre here at the museum. We're very fortunate. And why I had the opportunity to go and spend some time in the research centre after working on the 1913 exhibition Glorious Days. And my topic was to look at the unauthorised satires against Joseph Banks. Now, lest you think that I have a sort of a fixation on powerful dead men, I'm actually very interested in how they fit into their society and the things that make them real for us at this stage, more than 200 years later. And it is the satires that were published against Banks that are so revealing of his society, his place in it, and the difficulties that people experienced at the beginning of celebrity culture. So we have, the Kardashians and all sorts of nonsense on the television and in all those newspapers and magazines. Those are an example of early 21st century celebrity culture. But celebrity culture has been around for an awfully long time and took on its modern form in the 1760s. It's a congruence of mass consumption, mass communications, and mass distribution. So press was taking off, people had incomes that were quite a lot of disposable income at this time. And there was also that business where a previously fixed social hierarchy was beginning to break down under the fact that people, if you could look like a gentleman, you could act like a gentleman, you could be accepted as a gentleman. it only cost a shilling, which was the bar that would keep the hoi polloi out, to get into the various, you know, gardens, concerts, art galleries, displays, performances. And increasingly, members of the middle class had that shilling to spend. People from other parts of Europe who visited London would complain that it was so hard to tell who was a gentleman and who was not. But of course, what it meant was that people were enormously interested in how you rise. They wanted to know, how do you improve your status? So they became very interested in celebrity, because celebrity, there were two paths for advancement. One is called One is basically you're born into a status. You're the king, member of the royal family, one of the nobility. You know, you have ascribed celebrity as a result of your birth and blood. But from 1760, there was also the category, although of course it had been around for a long time, of achieved celebrity. This is where you become a celebrity on the basis of your skill, your remarkable beauty, your physical strength, your achievement of extraordinary undertakings, like Cook, like Omai. So people began to read about these celebrities so that they could ape them, they could become like them, they could learn how to enhance their own status. Now, Banks, of course, already had status as the son and heir of a wealthy landowner, but he enhanced his own status even more as a result of his voyages to the Pacific, or his voyage to the Pacific. And he became the confidant of the king after spending 2 weeks in his house with the king, showing him all the marvellous things that he'd collected and had, the artworks and such. And he used those early experiences as a leverage to achieve permanent status. So once he had permanent status as the president of the Royal Society, he was less interested in being a celebrity and, in fact, tried to keep the press at arm's length. They tend not to stay at arm's length once you've let them in. And Banks had lots and lots of trouble with the press, which brought me to the issue of the satires, because they were the unauthorised portraits and the unauthorised statements about Banks, such as, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Macaroni Prince, but so it was that alternative side, the dark side of celebrity, that I was spending my time working on. And the paper that I presented earlier this year in London was called Fame's Dark Twin, Joseph Banks and Celebrity. So these are all the sorts of things that are part of my work as a curator, part of the work that I do for the museum, and will no doubt form the basis for the next exhibition that I desperately want to work on, which will be on the life of Joseph Banks, but it will be the unauthorised biography. I hope people will come and see it. Okay, well, now that's 40 minutes to the dot. So, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Michelle. 40 minutes to the dot. Do you have a clock down there?
I do.
Well done. Has anybody got any questions for Michelle?
Thank you. I'm sorry I was a bit late. I was held up in the traffic. Yes. I missed beginnings, but I did see a lot of your exhibitions, and I found your putting it all together was like a television series. Hmm. Have you ever thought that this is what could happen with all of this that you've put together? You're a very good researcher.
Oh, thank
and
you.
And I've really enjoyed your work, and I really didn't appreciate it as much as I had this morning. So thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you. I would love to do something like that. I find, everything I've worked on does, to my mind, seem to fit together, the next piece, the next piece, the next piece. It's all just been a giant voyage of discovery for me, working on these sorts of materials. I'm not quite sure how I would go about it. But it is something I would love to do. There is a book that I want to publish, but that's going to be a real slog.
Michelle, you and I can talk because I'm an ex-television curator and I can tell you how you can get that up. Okay. Go to the ABC and get funding from Screen Australia.
Yeah. Oh,
absolutely.
Right.
I know. But you can get money from Screen Australia, which it doesn't cost the ABC so much. Yeah, so just put in a proposal. Okay. You just need a producer, so talk to me later.
I will. An e-book. Well, that's a thought. Mm. Okay.
Hi. Hello. My question's actually about the exhibitions themselves. I wear glasses.
Ah, yes.
And I have a bad back.
Yes.
And when you put things, the labels, and I read everything, when you put them down low, I come out with a dreadfully sore back.
Yes.
Can we either have larger fonts or higher up, please?
Well, this is an argument I've been having with designers since my first exhibition. And I can remember I was very fortunate to go to Rosemary Dobson's 80th birthday, where John Mulvaney basically got me by the front of my shirt and said, "I can't read your captions." And I said, "I know." And, of course, my own eyesight's at the point now where glasses on, glasses off, glasses on, glasses off. So my most recent exhibition is actually at Macquarie Bank down in Sydney, and we think we might have found the solution. This exhibition is in a tiny, tiny little space, 25 square metres. It's sort of like a big marble bathroom, and there's a lot of light coming in, and there's not a lot of space. So what we've done is we've used iPads. iPads on nice big tall stalks. iPads that you can actually pick up and read, and iPads that you can stretch to make it bigger. It's also meant that I can put so much more information. We're always in a bit of a bind. There's only so much space in an exhibition. People assume that it's the objects that people have come to look at, but of course, if you don't know what you're looking at, you know, perhaps that is just a stick, you know. So we always have this huge battle with our designers. We also have a battle with people who think that the public aren't interested in reading. So when we do surveys, and there's some, you know, you'll sometimes see somebody sort of wandering along behind you with a little clipboard. They're measuring how long you spend at each point. And there are some people, of course, who walk in, go zoom, and walk straight out. You know, 10 minutes, I think, is pretty standard for your average museum visitor. So we get told people don't want to read long things. And that's another reason why I've always wanted to do books rather than just do the exhibition. But now that we have the opportunity to use new technology, I will do my best to encourage people to have more text. And if you only want to read the title, that's fine. That'll be there for you too. But if you're interested in that deeper level, it will be there. And of course, these days too, we put things up on the web, which isn't, you know, I mean, I suppose you could walk around with your own iPad checking out what's on the web while you're in the exhibition, and some people do that, but it also means that it makes it accessible for people who can't actually get into the exhibition, which as a national institution, we are very keen on making happen. But yes, I share your pain.
I've just been at the Museum of South Australia and they address that problem. As you walk into each room, there is a lot of sheets in very large font that you can pick up, and you look at each painting and it's written on it. And so for people who are not technology savvy,
yes,
it's an old-fashioned way of looking as well.
That is a very good idea.
And then people are not standing right in front of the exhibition reading it, so nobody else can see.
Yes, I'll remember that one too, because that's an excellent solution.
Okay.
Thank you. I think Gabriel's got our last question.
I'd just like to follow up on that comment, because the National Library has a series of big print little booklets with the exhibitions they put on their treasure room. So you can pick that up and read where you are.
Mm.
And you don't have to stand in front of the picture necessarily, but it's good to see that very big print.
Yeah.
And you can just take your time using it. The other question I have is, are your catalogues still in print? I like the original books.
I'm not sure how many of them are still in print. I think that we sold out of The World Upside Down very quickly. When I was in London late last year, I found a copy of my Cook and Oh My catalogue for sale for £2 in the British Library. I was tempted to buy it. I thought, oh, that's not a bad price. But I'm not sure. I have copies of my own, of course, and they are in libraries, and I gave copies to our library here. So there are copies in libraries, but I'm not sure if they're still available. If they are available, the National Library will be selling the ones that relate to those exhibitions. And the ones that I've done for the National Museum, I think, are still available here at our shop. Hmm.
Lovely. Michelle, I introduced you as being in Australian society, but they might be interested, other than the banks, what else you might be working on over the next year or two.
Yes. Okay. So I told you that I can't say no. I was asked, would I like to work on the Defining Moments of Australian History project? And when they told me that I could have Anne Farris to work with me, I said, yes, I will. And so this is the big program that was opened by Tony Abbott on the 29th of August this year at the museum. And there's information about it in the foyer at the moment. The idea is that quite a little while ago, a group of eminent Australian historians got together to define 100 moments, to make a list of 100 moments of Australian history that have been so significant in forming who we are. Now, of course, this is a list that is open to discussion. And that is actually what we want. We want people to engage with the list and to tell us what they think the most significant moments were. There's any range of things. You know, is there something missing from the list that you think should be there? Is there something on the list that you definitely think shouldn't be there? Is there a personal moment that you know about that is for you one of the defining moments of Australian history? Now, we're going to be using this project to do all sorts of fantastic things. There's going to be an international conference next year. We're going to have a history week. There are so many things going on that I can't actually remember them all because I only agreed to do it at the beginning of this week. But it is a way for the museum to move into greater conversation with the Australian public, and that's what we want to do. And we want to make resources available to people, so there's a lot up on the web. This is going to tie in very nicely with another project that's happening at the moment, which is the Google Cultural Institutions project. So Google have offered to record the outside of the museum and the inside of the museum. The fellow walks around with this weird sort of device on his back, and then that is loaded onto the internet, and you can take a virtual tour of the museum, and any object or the objects that you see, you can click on, and all the beautiful information that curators like me have been working on for years becomes available. I've seen the one on Angkor Wat, and it's just fantastic. I don't know that I will ever get to Angkor Wat, but at least I now know what it looks like to walk through, and it was extraordinary. So it's that whole business about increasing people's access to the museum and making the work that we do available. And, you know, these are hard times for cultural institutions. I'm sure there have been times that have been less hard, but this one does feel like a particularly hard time. And we need our friends, and we need to have a presence. And the Defining Moments project will help with both of those things.
Well said, Michelle. Look, if you could join me again in thanking Michelle for stepping in, and on farewell and happy Christmas to you all. Mm. And thank Michelle once more. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.